Expanding Mind with Eric Davis, Thursdays at 2 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Of Expanding Mind, I'm your host, Eric Davis, and we will continue our exploration of the cultures of consciousness. We've also often had occasion to talk about Burning Man on the show. And
Peggy Nelson,
I'm calling. Hello? Peggy, are you talking already?
Yeah.
I was going to introduce you first. We often have occasion to talk about Burning Man on this show. And I think, you know, there's many wonderful experiences out there. And for those of you who haven't been, one aspect of the festival is that it's an enormous, dusty gallery space on a kind of epic post-apocalyptic scale. So a lot of the work people do out there is artwork. And a lot of it's monumental, a lot of it's explosive, a lot of it is bizarre and scatological. Some of it is good, some of it is terrible. But a lot of it works because it's such a peculiar environment to see art. And people often just spend their days and nights kind of bouncing around like pinballs, wandering from here to there, stumbling into marvels, being told about marvels and sent on their various pilgrimages. And one of my favorite pieces that people have done there is kind of on a somewhat different scale. Our guest today, Peggy Nelson, who is an artist who does a lot of media related work, a lot of things using the internet, and has done a lot of more traditional art forms as well. But this was in some ways one of her first moves towards a kind of mediated space. So rather than go out to the playa and, you know, build another enormous weird thing or some clanking machine or blow something up or some, you know, bizarre image, she created an audio tour, kind of like those wonderful things they have in, you know, when you go to a big show, Van Gogh retrospective, the Olmec heads or whatever. You go to an art museum and they have these audio tours, which I think are wonderful, not because I use them, but because all the people who are using them shut up. So it's actually a very quiet experience with a lot of people because they're all listening to the pre-digested information, which can be good. But most of the time, it's kind of irritating because I don't want some, you know, art historian middle brow framing my experience of an Olmec head or a Van Gogh painting. I want to go there and see what happens. I know that's naive, but I love my naivete. Anyway, so Peggy took advantage of this this weird medium and created an audio tour, sort of like randomized audio tour, where you could go and pick up your little record, you know, your portable recording device and put on the headphones, and you could select different comments wherever you wanted to. So she had these wonderful collection of sort of musings on art and space, and some of it was sound, some of it was music, and you would call these things up randomly, which is the perfect reflection of the basic logic of Burning Man, which is a very random space, even in its art. And all these marvelous synchronicities would happen. It was just a great way of, like, reflecting on the space even as she intensified it, rather than going for, like, that incredible immediate experience of the exploding car. You know, you could listen to sort of commentary, but the commentary would come in this random way where who knew what kind of connections would be made. So for me, that was the first time. I had known Peggy for many years, but it was the first thing that she did where I was really like, wow, this is really cool. And she's since gone on to do all sorts of interesting things that we'll be talking about in terms of bringing art into the media space, into our ordinary use of technology, and really shaping things up. But I'm not sure if we have our guest or our co-host on today. Maja, are you here today?
I'm totally here, man.
That's great. So usually we talk about this beforehand, but there were some technical snafus before the show started. So I don't know, what's the last art show you've been to?
Oh, man. The last art show I went to was actually a group art show that had all kinds of crazy... You were there, too. It was the one with the Aleister Crowley piece and the Cameron piece. That was like a year ago or something, right?
Yeah, that was actually... That was a wonderful show. It was a... I can't remember... Wasn't that good? Do you remember the name of the gallery?
Oh, I'm totally spacing it out right now.
It's so lame. We're such
lame.
Bad cultural commentators.
But it was like an alchemical art show, basically.
Yeah. It was full of very dense, intense, mystical images, and I don't think there was any media there. So I'm glad we're going to be moving into a fresher zone with Peggy Nelson. I think Peggy, are you calling in from where are you? You're in Massachusetts.
I am. I'm in Boston.
Wonderful. Well, welcome to the show.
Thanks a lot. It's good to be here.
Are you in some kind of chamber? You sound like you're in like a kind of echoey chamber.
That's great. I'm in a custom designed recording studio at my day job.
Oh, that's why. Cause it's so
but apparently the sound baffles aren't really.
No. I think
effective.
It's working.
I can hear it on the phone.
No, it's working all too well. It's that it's usually you hear the resonance.
Oh, do I sound all right?
So it's so. You're crystal clear. It's beautiful.
Okay, great.
Anyway, well, thanks for being on the show. I don't know if you wanted to talk at all about that Burning Man piece. I mean, I know there's a lot of things we can chat about, but I'm kind of even curious, like how you came up with that. Like, what were you thinking about? What did you want to sort of open up with that?
Yeah, that's a really good question. Actually, I do want to talk about that because I think it's a pivotal moment in my work. I've been going to Burning Man for a number of years at that point. We did DJCS, the rave opera, back in 99. And in between then and when I came up with the idea for the audio tour, I had been struggling about what kind of art should I bring personally to the playa, besides, you know, my attitude or a great costume or something like that. And I thought, well, at that point I was painting, as you know, it's my degree, and I thought, well, you know, bring a bunch of paintings out there, they'll just get ripped down in a dust storm. And how could they speak to the chaotic natural and cultural space that is the playa? And then I thought, well, I'll do something really big, you know, like with lasers, do a picture in the sky, or I'll dig, you know, ignore the leave no trace thing and like dig a labyrinth. And all that just seemed completely derivative, besides expensive, and I'd need a lot of people involved. And it's just like nothing spoke to me. And then I realized that was it. It was the speaking. I would do a painting with sound, but not with a concert or with a, you know, a presentation or loud, you know, continuous located sound. I do discontinuous small nodes of sound that could cover the playa like a net, like knots in a net. So you have plenty of space in between. It wouldn't blow over. It wouldn't be very expensive. And it would paint a picture in people's minds as they walked around. Now, I was also influenced by the concept of the Delif that Guy Debord kind of instantiated over in Europe mid-century, the idea of psychogeography, where we get a bunch of unemployed artists and intellectuals, and they stumble around to the various bars and people's apartments, and they claim that that's the real experience of the urban environment. You know, it's not the State House, it's not the Grand Avenues, it's these little mouse trails that you make with your friends. And I thought, well, they sort of drift through the space. I will make an audio tour. And that's what you do with Burning Man, is you drift around. You drift around from spectacle to eddy to you're out in the middle of nowhere till you're in the middle of this incredible dance concert. And I thought, people do the Delive out there anyway. I'll make an audio tour, like a museum guide for that. But the thing about psychogeography is it's not supposed to be guided. You're supposed to drift. It's not supposed to be like, okay, you're at a listening station. So I decided that not only would I have these sound pieces, I think there are about 20, that you could put on shuffle on your MP3 player, but I would decide that the listening stations were up to the user. So I had a clothes rack, and I installed it out, you know, sort of by 2:30, where there wasn't pretty much anything on the playa, and the clothes rack was out there in the desert, and there was these little MP3s hanging from the clothes rack, and people could take them like you take one in a museum. And then proceed along their way, wander around, and when they felt that they were at a listening station, whatever that meant, they'd play a thing at random. And the feedback that I got from it was people said everything matched up. And then people took it home from the playa, and I got email from people from Los Angeles, and people did it on the Freedom Trail in Boston and New York and Grass Valley, and they said everything matched up there too. So I thought that was fascinating. Not only did it work as painting a series of images on the playa, but it worked in terms of exploring how we're really pattern-making animals.
Well, I want to ask you about, you used the phrase painting, you know, you still use the metaphor of painting to describe the way that these sound pieces sort of interacted with this, the experience, the physical experience of being on the playa. Why do you still think of it in terms of painting as opposed to, you know, sort of a commentary on audio comments or other ways of thinking about it? What's the metaphor of painting there?
Well, I think that was a legacy metaphor. I don't think about it in terms of painting anymore.
Mm-hmm.
But at that point, I had been painting for a number of years and doing these big sort of collage series things and starting to think about sequential art and space and narrative. But I was, I had an MFA in painting and I was fully committed to my identity as a fine artist with the entire weight of thousands of years of art history.
It's wonderful the way that the media kind of tricked you, you know. It's like, you know, oh yeah, yeah, this will be a way to paint, and now look at you, you know. Actually,
this is what I found as a new media artist, is that you approach every media in a context of the media that you're coming from. So first people got computers and they did paintings on the computer, and now we have a very different art that's on the computer, and we'll be talking about some of that. But we can't, just drop our legacy thing and immediately immerse in some kind of new perceptual framework. We have to bridge into it.
Yeah, before we get off the topic of the derive, I want to stay with that a little bit more because I think
something about it really fast, actually?
Excuse me?
Hello? I'm sorry. I just wanted to say something about it really fast because what you had mentioned about how humans are pattern-making animals, your project sounds so fascinating to me because way back in the late 1800s when animal magnetism was popular, mm-hmm. there was this fellow named Baron Dupotier who would do experiments in magnetism, and he did something very much like your project actually, where he would go through a room, he would have the room empty, and then he would make a line, like just walk in an imaginary line. And then he would have all these people in the other room waiting that couldn't see where he was going, and then he would just invite them one at a time to come in the room and see what path they would travel on. And what he found was that everyone would walk the same line that he had traced out himself when he went in there, and that people would get attracted to the same lines that other people were taking. So when you put that into artistic terms with sound and stuff like that, it actually, like to me, sounds like it follows those same patterns of even like the animal magnetism experiments of the 1800s.
Oh my God, that is fascinating. I gotta look that guy up.
Yeah, that's really great. I mean, I like it partly also because I think when you... What I was saying about the derive is that I really think that people should be encouraged to try your own version of this more often, because it's a completely wonderful way to move through space, especially when you travel, when you're in an unfamiliar city. And anybody who's traveled knows, you know, you show up to Paris, you've never been there before, and you have your guidebook and you have the map, and there's already a map. There's already like a circuit that you just kind of put your body into, and you'll go to all the places that everybody already knows how to go to. And so it's almost like this animal magnetism thing is if we use other media to support the kind of repetition of a certain pathway. But when you get off that pathway, so many more marvelous things, you know, can happen. So many more discoveries. You're in your own imagination and in the realities of the city and in strange juxtapositions. And one way that I like to do the derive on my own, which is totally like narcissistic and not very, you know, a lot of the psychogeographers are really political, which I admire, but like the way I do it is I start out on a corner and I'm like, okay, it's a dream. I'm in a dream. I'm in a lucid dream and I'm woke and I'm awaking. So what am I going to do? And I'll scan the field for anything that's the most dreamlike. A weird sculpture, the name of the street, some particularly ugly but attractive person who's walking somewhere, the way the light's bouncing off a building. Oh, wait, maybe it must be that building that I have to go to. And then I go to the next spot and then I scan the environment for what's the most dreamlike thing and just bounce along. And after 10, 15 minutes, things get very strange. And if I keep a record of it, it's this like wonderful kind of like psychic ping pong. And I wound up in completely marvelous places. And it's a really great, you know, kind of routine. And in a way, Peggy, that's already part of Burning Man. That's part of what makes it fun. And I just love the way that you kind of like added it into this sort of the kind of metaphor of the audio tour, which is so kind of dorky and millbrow. and it just takes it in this other direction. So anyway, we don't have to keep talking about that piece.
That's great, though.
So I want to talk about another piece. I think, given that we often talk about magic on the show, because that's the kind of people we are, I think it might be great if you'd introduce talk about Scriber Space and just even a little bit about the whole what led you to it and all that.
Absolutely, that's my current project or one of them. So Scriber Space is an online search oracle, and it's motivated by sort of two concerns. One is that this idea of internet addiction, that you sit at the computer and you're clicking away and it's 2 a.m. and you haven't really, like, what are you doing? And you know, your body's sort of crumpled up, but you just want to make that one more link because it's going to be something, you don't know what. You think it's, but our attitude towards that kind of obsessive clicking through on the internet, I think, is more akin to a sort of occult anticipation. Like, it's more of a quest than I'm looking something up in the library. And that's been very interesting to me. And concurrent with that, remember in the 90s when the web started and there were all those different search engines, and there were a couple of other things that you could do on the web, but it was not clear that searching was going to become such a central part of our experience. I mean, everybody has a different experience, but it certainly was not the case in my life that I was looking stuff up all the time. And that's certainly what I do at least half of the time online these days. And so I thought, why is it that the search has become almost the default paradigm for what we do online? And I thought that also ties into this sort of quest metaphor. It's more of a seeking than search. And so I created a character, John D. He has a Twitter account based, of course, on Elizabeth I's court astrologer. And I thought, well, he can help people in this search because I don't want to write a rational algorithm that's going to help them look stuff up. I want to stay with the collection of symbols that seems to be what they're really after. So what you do is you log on to his website, which is a Tumblr site, and he also has a Twitter account, and you ask him a question. And I've received all sorts of questions from basically what's the meaning of life to very factual-based things like how was fluorescence discovered? And then what John D. will do, because Scriber Space is based on a play on words. Of course, there's scrying, which is to predict the future through various media. And there's scribing, which is writing, and the entire internet is written, both in the pages that you look at, written in code, and the web 2.0, where we're blogging and Twittering all the time. And so those two conflate, and what John D. does is he goes and he scours the publicly available stuff on the web, which is all created by us, but not immediately accessible to any one of us at any one singular time. And as soon as something is out of our direct grasp, it's the unknown. And as soon as it's the unknown, it's a mystery, and we imbue it with presence, or at least with messages from, perhaps, a presence. And so what he does is he goes out and he sort of deluges around the internet and picks things that he thinks might relate to the question. And then the answer appears in the form of a sound collage, a video collage, or an animated GIF along generally with some text. Because the idea is not to just answer the question. It's to address the quest.
Yeah, that's such a wonderful thing that you're bringing that back. Even you describing the project reminds me of how different it was to search back in the day. And it's always seems a little dorky going like, oh, well, back in when the internet first started. But we are who we are, and so I can remember when the web first started, I was online already, et cetera, et cetera. And you're right, there was something much more sort of odd and wonderful and kind of playful about the idea of a search. I remember hanging out with Terrence McKenna in the late 90s, and he talked about he talked about the search. I think he was already talking about Google, but I don't remember what service. But it was just the idea of using it as an oracle and to like ask it divinatory questions. And of course, part of the reason is that in the 90s, what the pages that would be called up, if you put in a bunch of weird words that didn't really relate, like, you know, crocodile lemon face, then you'd get really weird things. But most of the time now, things aren't that. It's all kind of routinized, just as our searching is routinized. We even forget that it has this, that we're sitting at a magical tablet asking questions, you know, about the universe and getting back these answers. I mean, it's a completely bizarre and wonderful situation. So that's such a great, you know, that's what I like about this, the media stuff that you do. It's not just like, oh, that's an interesting, funny thing. You know, oh, that's kind of cool, like da-da-da-da. It's that you kind of you force us to reframe and kind of refresh the way that we interact with these machines that are so consuming, and yet they kind of they're like fake transparencies. We don't think about it anymore. Oh yeah, I'm just using Google because I want to find out where the nearest hairdresser is, blah blah blah, and you kind of lose the possibilities, the openness, the creative extent of the situation that we're in, because it's so routinized, it's so made like business as usual.
Well, and I like too how you would answer with things other than words and text, like collages and images and sounds, because that's interesting to me, just because one thing I find that I started doing when people would ask me questions and emails and stuff, sometimes I just send them a link to a YouTube song. And I don't even ask them at all, and I'll just send them like a YouTube link, and that will answer like whatever they're asking. And so that, to me, you can like further develop an oracle answer that someone's asking, because it's not even restricted to scribing or language. You can break out of that in these media forms. So I think that's genius.
It reminds me of a thing that I used to do, you know, again, back in the day when things were more, you know, wild and woolly online. And I fell in with these characters who would play the glass bead game. And the glass bead game is this game from the Hermann Hesse novel, Magister Luti. And you know, it's this way of like it takes place in a future when sort of everybody agrees that all the great creative acts of human history have already been done, and what everybody does at that point is kind of just sift through and understand and reflect on this enormous archive of material. So it's a very appropriate thing in some ways for where we are now, because we're all archivists. We play with this enormous archive daily. And what happened with the glass bead game is you would just start something like a figure, like the word rose. And then someone would like kind of like, it was like tennis, and you'd maybe hit back with like a, you know, the rose window in a cathedral. And then somebody else would make a comment on Chartres. And then someone else, and it was again that kind of associative dreamlike logic, just like we were talking about earlier, except using the materials of the web. And it was really fun, and it was just real simple, and they had much more elaborate plans for how to take it to the next level. And I've even heard some people doing it, but I haven't experienced it. But it's again that kind of associative thinking, like dream thinking, seems to be one of the things that you're interested in.
Yeah, I think that's a really good way to put it. I have to do some more thinking about how dreams specifically might inform the work. But certainly when you were describing that, and how I was describing the Baron's pathways through the room, I mean, I think that when you start making these associational patterns, you're dealing with a certain kind of vibration. And it might not be a vibration-like sound, but it might be a vibration-like sound. It's certainly some kind of conceptual resonance. And the more of these patterns that you make, the more that you're sort of creating an entity that you're in sync with, or, you know, there's the Jungian idea of, you know, constellating, when you're really onto something and the coincidences start happening and everything seems related to everything, it's like a constellating around you. And I think that's sort of what we can make through some of these pathways through the internet and other technologies. You know, there's definitely an occult metaphor that permeates this stuff. And it's really interesting, as you said, that it's become so normalized and so routinized, because it's really not normal and routine at all.
Not at all. Was there a reason you picked John Dee? I mean, there's all sorts of magical figures. What was it about Dee that attracted you?
I think it was not necessarily a direct connection, but I was interested in Dee because of his relationship to Edward Kelly and because of how people say similar to L. Ron Hubbard in terms of may have had some kind of, you know, imagination gift, but also definitely had a gift for hucksterism in the cell. And John Dee's relationship both with him and his position in terms of being in the period right before where magic was very separated out from science. You know, he did it all. He was supposed to be, you know, finding out facts and finding out, you know, these other kinds of facts, esoteric facts. And in the eras after him, those were pursuits. And
yeah,
I also just like his name, Dee.
No, it's totally perfect. I mean, that seems like a good thing to remember, that like there was a point just before the emergence of modern science as we think about it now, when people were doing science and doing mathematics and doing cosmology and doing physics and doing chemistry, but they were doing it simultaneously with things that we now think of as being totally different, of being magical, alchemy, enchantment, you know, delusion or fantasy or whatever. And those things, which are, you know, always tied on some level or another, were very, very richly woven together. And in some ways, the world that we're in now, even though there's so much difference between science and religion and all these different fields of the modern world, in some ways there's also that sense that like what we're about now is like novel ways of connecting and communicating, which isn't just between people, but between ways of seeing the world and how to move through it. And I used to really hold out, and for a while it really looked like the internet was going to be aggressively involved in sort of creating that new intelligent, critical, but still associative linkages, but in a lot of ways, I mean, it's there, but it's not brought forward. So it's something that I think, again, it's important about the kind of stuff that you do and other people, that sort of reminds us of the potential of the space. Mm-hmm. Anyway, I think it's time to take a break. So we'll come back and talk about some of your other pieces after the break. This is Eric Davis. You're listening to Expanding Mind, and we're talking with Peggy Nelson, me and Maja Daou, and we'll be right back after these messages.
This is PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
Do you want to listen to your favorite PRN show in your car or when you're out for a jog? You can download any show on the archives at any time. Visit the archives at progressiveradionetwork.com/archives. We can also be found in the iTunes store under Progressive Radio Network. All our archives are free, so go ahead and check them out. Thanks for listening to the Progressive Radio Network. Stay tuned to stay informed.
This is Adam Colker with Brooklyn Jazz Underground Radio. We'll be here every Tuesday from 5 to 6 with great music, interviews, and live performances. Right here on PRN, the Progressive Radio Network. Again, that's Tuesdays from 5 to 6, or you can listen anytime at the archive at progressiveradionetwork.com.
Hello, this is Sound to Be Tay from Success Power Talk. You can listen live to me every Saturday at 4 p.m. Eastern Standard Time for the very best success strategies for your life, bringing you sumptuous, exciting topics, expert guests, and panelists from all over. You will not want to miss. Email me at coach@tateworks.com if you have questions you want read on the air. If you missed any past shows, go to progressiveradionetwork.com/archives to find them. Always take the best and leave the rest. Success Power Talks every Saturday, 4 p.m. on Progressive Radio Network.
Everyone, this is Richard Martin, host of your bi-weekly wake-up call, Mondays and Fridays at 10 a.m. Eastern Time, coming to you live all the way from Singapore. I try to cut through the lies and misinformation to bring you what you need to know to prepare for the economic horrors that lie ahead. I'll give it to you straight in simple language. I don't sugarcoat the news. Unlike the government and media, I have no agenda other than to make you aware of ways in which you can protect yourselves and your loved ones. That's the Wake Up Call, Mondays and Fridays at 10 a.m. here on Progressive Radio Network.
Are you asking questions about the fate of our planet, your spiritual direction, and how to find meaning in a fast-paced society? Voices of Wisdom with John Jeanette is here to answer those questions and more. Tune in every Friday at 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time to hear sacred activists and teachers exploring the meaning of contemporary culture. The show is produced by Wisdom University with regular commentary by Jim Garrison and Will Tagle. I'm your host, John Jeanette, and I look forward to your questions.
This is PRN, the Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome back, guys. This is Expanding Mind on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm Maja Daru, and we're here with Eric Davis. We're talking with Peggy Nelson about crazy art stuff, some of our favorite stuff to talk about. Peggy, Eric had mentioned science before the break, and I saw some of your work has a lot of alchemical themes, and you even had some straight-up paintings of viruses, which I thought was very awesome. And I was just wondering, what influenced you with science? Like, do you have scientific training in your background, or is it just kind of a hobby, or what kind of jazzed you to include science into a lot of your media presentations?
That's a really good question, Maja. I don't have any scientific training or background, beyond high school. I was going to be a chemistry major in college, but first semester freshman year sort of disabused me of that particular notion. But right. I've always been very interested in scientific imagery as it stands as imagery, like looking at it through an artist's eyes and a symbolic function. With the alchemical paintings, I was very interested in the fact that with the parallax that we have in time, like looking back however many years, 500, 600, those were representations of what they thought the facts of the world were. Like, this mm-hmm. is what is out there. These are the entities. Here's how they interact. Here's what we can conclude from that. It's a clear case of cause and effect. But us looking at them now, they look like outlandish pictures of snakes with three heads and weird metal spheres floating in the air and sort of people, you know, that are half man and half woman. And we're just like, this is crazy stuff. But back then it was facts. And so I look at our current scientific imagery, which is, you know, sort of very clean and streamlined and vector graphics, and I think, well, in a couple hundred years, this is going to look crazy too, because clean and Baroque crazy are both aesthetic metaphors. So I was fascinated by the fact that art and science, which seem to be such separate pursuits, really have an overlap in how they're representing information, and it's not something that's really fully acknowledged.
It's crazy that you clued in on that, because that there was this guy that wrote a book on alchemy called Johannes Fabricius, and mm-hmm. he goes through and looks at old alchemical pictures and puts them next to biological processes like meiosis and mitosis, which when I saw your website, you had the alchemy pictures like right next to the viruses, and he would show like how some of the Aruberus images were like the same as a zygote, and he would like literally look at them right next to each other, and they look the same. So it's very interesting that you kind of clued in on that just on your own, you know?
Yeah, I'm going to have to look him up. That sounds great. The other thing I should tell you about the alchemy piece and the virus pieces, is the alchemy pieces are actually two sheets of tissue paper each, and they're only fastened at the top when they're displayed. And as you walk around the room, the movement of your body in the air is enough of a breeze to make the tissue paper flap. And there's different images on the top and the bottom, and they go in and out of focus. So you can never really get at the truth of those images. You can never get to one final resting state because it's always in a kind of in-between flux. And I thought that's kind of how we do approach science. Like, we're always looking for the truth, but there's always like these assumptions that we're making, and we're not quite there yet, and the lenses aren't quite, you know, finely grained enough. So there's that going on in alchemy. And then with viruses, the thing that's not so apparent on the web is that those are actually wax and caustic on giant blankets. And so that was a commentary I lived in Amherst, Massachusetts for about a year and a half, which is named after Lord Geoffrey Amherst, who's the guy who initialed and signed off on the first documented use of biological warfare in the West. That was the whole smallpox and the blankets thing. And for a long time, I wanted to do something with viruses because I thought they had amazing structures and poetic names, but I couldn't think of what. And then it occurred to me that Amherst was the connection with that particular thing. And actually, when the first show that those were displayed in, it was displayed in conjunction with a series of films and performances about biology. And there were a number of medical students that came over to see the show. And they went all around the room and they identified, without looking at the index cards, the kinds of viruses. And they got to variola, which is smallpox. It's the one that looks like a big raccoon. And they all clustered around it, and they couldn't figure it out. They're like, we don't know what this one is. And the reason is because you can't see it under a microscope because it's in lockdown in Atlanta and somewhere in Russia. They don't see it. And that's, of course, the most famous one. So I thought that was very interesting.
Wow. That's fascinating. I went to a show once where a woman had done, like, crochet viruses. It was beautiful. But it's funny, like, with both viruses and alchemical images, like, even if you don't know you're looking at a virus, you just look at the pattern. There's something about the way that can be a certain density of pattern, and the same thing with, like, mandalas and alchemical diagrams, where you feel like it's not just, you know, a simple image. There's some kind of intelligence. There's some kind of complexity. There's some kind of, like, if not life, then the structure that leads to life, you know, inside that imagery. So it doesn't really surprise me that in some ways that these things can look similar. I mean, there's some Robert Flood images of, like, the sort of beginning of time, or, you know, the beginning of the opening of Genesis, but they look very much like star explosions. And there's a sort of weird level where these patterns, again, they leak out of their normal divisions between imagination and science and physical reality. So tell us another one. We got about 15 minutes left.
I would like to talk about, for the last thing, the Twitter movie, which is, I think, the first Twitter movie, and as far as I know, it's the only Twitter movie, which I did last year, which is called In Search of Adele H. And there was a lot of questions about why I call this a movie. So it's about a true story, but I could address the movie part first, if you want.
Well, also just tell us a little bit about Twitter, about using it, and, like, why that's the place worth doing this.
Right. So I got on Twitter, and I realized pretty early on that this is a storytelling medium. Everybody is constructing a character. The character is usually, you know, the me, the self, the I. But it's very much a performance. Even if you're just, like, tweeting about your breakfast, which not that many people do, even though that's the sort of cliche of what people do on Twitter. Anything that you're writing yourself, and whenever you write a version of yourself, it's you're constructing a character, and you're in fact performing that character. I would say even on things as prosaic as email, you're constructing a character. I mean, we've probably, most of us, if not all of us, have had the experience of meeting someone that we've all only known through, you know, web means, whether it's Twitter or email or a message board or something. And they're always very different than you expect them to be in one way or another, either different, good way or bad way, or just different, different. And that's because they're not the character that they're constructing, even though the character may very well be autobiographical. So with that in mind, I thought, well, I want to, you know, do a character. And I had had a screenplay that I had written the year before that, about Adele Hugo, which she was the youngest daughter of Victor Hugo. And you may know her from the wonderful Truffaut film, which is the story of Adele H., where basically she gets into a situation where he's just not that into you. And she falls in love with this, you know, unremarkable guy and follows him around the world. He's a soldier, and she follows him from camp to camp. And he basically can't give her the time of day. And that's it for her. She eventually goes crazy. And in the meantime, she's writing and writing and writing and writing and all these incredible fantasy things. And she's writing a journal in French, but in code, so that nobody can peek in and see it. And I saw the film, and I had heard about it, because it's from the 70s, and people say, oh, it's very depressing, it's very beautiful, and this and that. And I saw it, and I thought, you know, actually, it's very familiar. It's not so different from what many people in it, especially women, situations that they get into in relationships. But the difference, this is what I perceive, between us and her, is that we have the kind of society and social situations and options that we don't have to put all our hopes and dreams into one relationship or one person or even the idea of a relationship. We're able to separate out the money from the love and the love from the other symbols and have a support group of like other cool smart men and know just a lot more people. And I thought if she was living now, would this have happened? And I wanted to make sort of a Sherman's March type film about that, but I never really got that enthusiastic about it because, you know, it is just a depressing story. And I thought, no, I'll make her a Twitter character. And so I decided that I would perform this movie on Twitter, and she would tweet her life, and she would chronicle, you know, the things that happened to her as if she was living now. But she deviated from the movie script that I had kind of developed almost immediately, because her life inside cyberspace was so much like her fantasy life in her head in the 19th century, in the, you know, quill pen and paper phase, that she ended up having a lot to say about inventing characters and new media and kind of a networked self approach. And so I just let her kind of go with that. And I called it a movie because it's a series of posts for a couple of seconds a day over a 10-month period. I intended those to construct sort of a timeline of the activities that she was doing and, you know, the people that she was involved with. So a very long, slow kind of Tarkovskian movie. But that occurs in your head, not unlike Yoko Ono's instruction pieces, where it's just an index card on a wall and it says, imagine a painting of a blue sky or something like that.
Did you find that any of her story was autobiographical for you?
Very much. I mean, that's what sort of drew me to her story. You know, I've had all sorts of, you know, relationships, you know, some requited, some unrequited. But I think if you even had one unrequited relationship, you can sort of feel her pain. I mean, there was nobody at the time to say to her, he's just not that into you. And there's a reason why that phrase got hugely popular, is because that happens to everybody. And also,
yeah.
She's an artist, and she was wealthy. She had a certain amount of independence, but not enough psychological independence to really break out of the incredibly restrictive systems of that day. I mean, not many women were able to really break out back then. And, you know, I'm able to break out now. You are. Many of our friends are. But, you know, we have a lot more of a robust infrastructure to do that in.
Peggy, I wonder if you can also reflect on some of the other artworks that you've seen, or artists, or whatever you want to call them, writers, who are using Twitter in particular as a way to, like, play with this idea of character and of time as well. It seems like this idea of telling stories, not just creating fictional characters, like there's a guy who does the Hulk, and that's pretty funny. But but actually kind of playing with time, and even like the language of different times. And there seems to be something interestingly, I won't say profound, but sort of unusual about that environment, which people tend to think of in a very simplistic way. So I'd love to hear you kind of talk about what you discovered about Twitter by doing Adele H and how you think it kind of, you know, talks to some other things that are going on.
Definitely. I mean, when I started Adele H, I realized pretty quickly that there were a number of her compatriots out there, by which I mean real people who lived in previous centuries, who had been kind of resurrected on Twitter and were tweeting in a weird mashup, as was she, about the things of their time or through the perspective of their time on 21st century events. So one of the best examples is Dr. Johnson. There's someone who tweets as Dr. Samuel Johnson, and he kind of writes in the style of his essays with, you know, the perfect bon mot and a lot of capital letters. But he tweets about things that are happening right now in London. And there's a number of people who are sort of tweeting famous people's diaries, like there's Charles Darwin, there's George Orwell, there's John Adams. But that is not as successful as the mashups, because people's diaries just tend to be literally what they had for breakfast. And what really enlivens this space is the sort of, you need to push it further. You can't just sort of use it as a mouthpiece for something that's been previously written, you know, legacy media again. You need to push it to that next level, which is this weird mashup between, you know, past times and present activity.
But it's funny.
Even with Adele's perspective on 21st century mores and options, she still made the same choices, and she still went crazy and followed the guy, even on Twitter.
But there's something about the comment quality of it, like that there are these characters whose sort of perceptions and sort of aphorisms kind of like float through our, you know, hyper fast data overload kind of data processing minds that we have when we're online, when there's just, we know that every step we take that we're going to be surrounded and inundated. And even though there's this very narrow bandwidth of just a small burst of text in this flow of text, there's something very appealing about the continuity of characters, whether people are playing themselves and just sort of having an interesting Twitter line, or whether they're creating these other kind of characters and really playing with that. There's something about the voice that there's something very human about it, even though it's completely bizarre in 21st century.
Those are two sides of the same coin, and really important points. One is the micro moments, which in this like hyper network, hyperactive world that we all live in, and that scales all the way up and down, micro moments are pretty much all we have. Like, I was struck at the very beginning how, Maji, you said the last art show you said you went to, which sounded great, about Crowley, was a year ago. Yeah. And honestly, I don't even go to art shows that often, because there's no time. I don't even have time to watch a 5-minute video online. We have these micro moments, and we don't want to interrupt what we're doing to go to a designated space and a designated time and a designated attention span and really, like, limit our focus to that, and then we go back to our real life. Like, now, all we have is the real life. And so the special moments have to be filtered and integrated into these micro moments. But then it doesn't mean that they're trivial, because the other side of the coin of the micro moments is that if you persist with these aphorisms, like specifically we're talking about Twitter, we use that again as an example, like Adele H was a couple of seconds a day. And in fact, my own Twitter feed is probably even less frequent than that. But it accumulates. Hers was 10 months, mine is now a couple years. And over that span of time, you build an idea of a character, and you build a relationship with other people, and you build a persistence. And with that agglomeration or whatever you want to call it, that begins to develop its own sort of wants and needs and desires and attributes. And that, I think, is the really interesting thing that we're going to see in this kind of art media space in the near future, is sort of learning how to wrangle that animal, the thing that's composed of tiny little distributed bursts that yet persist and accumulate over time.
Yeah, one of the things I like about what you're saying is that, you know, as the media space changes, you know, we experience time differently, or there's kinds of time that are available. And one of the things about this, about just to continue talking about Twitter and about these micro moments and how they get stitched together, is that it's actually a kind of a workable frame for the epiphany. That yes. That the idea of an epiphany, which is kind of like a secular mystical insight, you know, is that if you go back to the word, it's in James Joyce in Portrait of the Artist, where it's just the way that a clock looks in the light. And we all have these moments every day, and we're so busy, mm-hmm. we don't usually remember them. Like something happens, and then we let it go, and then at the end of the day, we feel like all we've done is work. But if you actually pay attention, you realize that you overheard this interesting phrase, or you saw the light bouncing off of an ordinary object, or you suddenly realize something very specific about a relationship you have. And there's a way in which those elements are just as much are like at the core of who we are as the kind of more conventional stories of I came from here, and then I became this a Christian, and then I became a scientist, and then this happened, and I met this person. You know, these stories we think constitute us that are so broken up by our contemporary experience. But the epiphany, those moments, those almost poetic insights, even in the midst of like ridiculous situations of airports and dealing with technology and being on the phone with some guy from India, like all these crazy things, there's still always that possibility for that micro moment. So when you start doing micro moments with the Twitter or some other kind of way, there's actually a space for those. They still percolate through this very claustrophobic environment.
There's a way to record your dreams in a way, to go back to your dream metaphor.
T.S. Eliot writes beautifully about that in Four Quartets. He has that section that goes sudden in a shaft of sunlight.
Mm-hmm.
You know, which one I'm talking, where he talks about how just in that moment where he saw the dust particles in the sunlight, he comes to an epiphany, and it's just because like the sun hit the dust in a micro moment. But I think it's important to mention that, because people actually separate themselves from their Twitter reality. They view Twitter as like not even really part of their real reality. They were just Twittering, and they make these separations between their internet activities and their activities in real life. And to say that those micro moments people spend on the internet are part of their lives accumulatively is an important thing for people to realize, because then you get these like schizophrenic people that will like go only on internet porn, and then like they have an alternate schizoid character that they exist in that moment that they don't integrate. So I think making art that forces people to realize that is literally psychologically curative.
Absolutely. I'm in total agreement with you. We have this false separation between the virtual and the real that's sort of enabled by the fact that we've made these machines that model a part of the brain. And the fact is that we're virtual and real animals and spirits and whatever all the time. We were before computers, we will be afterwards. And if computers offer a way for us to sort of separate that out a little bit, look at it more closely, record it better, but then reintegrate it, it never really left us. And we need to get rid of that false dichotomy and reinvigorate the poetry that's in our everyday lives anyway.
Well, we only have a couple more minutes, and I wanted to let listeners know that they can go look at your work and all the pieces we've talked about and a lot of other ones on PeggyNelson.com. And I was also wondering whether there's anything coming up that you want to let people know about or think other projects online.
Yes, there's two other things coming up. One is a Twitter Chronicle. It's an action adventure. Based on Ernest Shackleton's doomed voyage with the Endurance, which suspends disbelief to the extent that no novel and no chronicle and no film, and I've seen them all, includes everything that happened to him. So I'm going to include everything.
Tell people, what did he do? What did he do?
Facebook intervention through Facebook ads, which you'll probably be seeing on your right-hand column at some point in the next month. But I can't tell you more than that right now. It's it's got to do with Philip K. Dick, though.
Very good. Well, we love Philip K. Dick here at Expanding Minds. And then just one note, Shackleton, he wanted to go to the South Pole, right?
South Pole, yep. He wanted to cross the southern continent.
Do you have a name do you have an address for it yet?
Yeah, it's the Twitter feed is E. Shackleton.
Excellent.
His name was Ernest, so that would be Ask E. Shackleton.
Thanks very much, Peggy. This is Eric Davis with Maja Dau on Expanding Mind. Keep your minds open.